The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Question number one, who is the preacher? First, as to the word, they tell us that the Hebrew word is Kohelet, which you would render in English characters as K-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. It's a word which is only used in this book, when it's used seven times. But it is related to a Hebrew verb, kahal, and the noun, kahal, both of which seem to be concerned with an assembly, a congregation. And in fact, the noun is a quite common word in the Old Testament used for the congregation of the children of Israel. It might seem a little bit more familiar to you if I say that when you get the Greek Old Testament, they render it by our favourite word, ecclesia, ecclesia. So that the assembly which is referred to in the Old Testament of the chosen people who were then the Jews, and its successor in spiritual things, the assembly of the saints in the New Testament, the chosen people who are the new Israel of God, gathered out from all nations, are all representable by this word in Greek, ecclesia, and in Hebrew, kahal. So a kohelet is somebody who either gathers together an assembly, or assembles with other people, or addresses an assembly. I think we might well at this point suggest that this is the first piece of evidence that we really are talking about Solomon, because you will possibly all recall, and today's reading should have given you an introduction to it as well, that one of the earliest acts of Solomon when he became king was to gather together the people at the high place that was then at Gibeon and beseech his God for wisdom, and then and later address the people and approach God in a most eloquent prayer, desiring that God would grant his blessings upon a faithful people and his mercy upon a people in their sins. So the words of the preacher very probably mean the words of the man who once gathered together the assembly and addressed it, and perhaps did so on many other times afterwards. The son of David. Well, that's not quite so decisive, of course, because although Solomon was the son of David, he was not the only son of David. And although the first generation after a man is often called the generation of sons, it's used in other ways too. And when we remember that the Gospel of Matthew opens by telling us that Jesus Christ was the son of David, the son of Abraham, and yet he was removed by many generations from David, the words are not in themselves decisive as to whether Solomon is really being talked about. It could be. It wouldn't absolutely have to be. It could be anybody between Solomon and Zedekiah, in the line of the kings of David. King in Jerusalem. Well, all that does is rule out the northern tribes. It still leaves us with all the kings of the house of David as a possibility, if we hadn't already half made up our minds that it was Solomon that was being talked about. Is it Solomon? Well, there's a clue in verse 16 of this chapter. I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart hath had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly, and I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. So he had gotten more wisdom than all that were before him in Jerusalem. Well, the word wisdom suggests Solomon straight away. And until you've actually looked up the word in the concordance, one doesn't realise to what extent it does suggest Solomon and how powerful it is. A very belated piece of study fetched out this evidence that you might like to make a note of. That the word translated wisdom occurs 150 times in the Old Testament. And of those 150, at least 23 are in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles, and they're all about Solomon. At least 37 are in Proverbs, which is Solomon's book, and another 25 are in Ecclesiastes. If I've done my sum correctly, that means 85 out of a total of 150, or, don't be too critical of me here, 56%. You take the adjective wise, and that occurs about 131 times in the Old Testament, of which 117 are translated wise. And of those, 4 are in Kings and Chronicles, all about Solomon. 46 are in Proverbs, and 20 in Ecclesiastes. Which makes, I think, 70 out of 117 where the word is translated wise. So, when we note that all the references in the historical books are about Solomon, that there's a very large number of them in Proverbs, which is Solomon's book, and in Ecclesiastes, which is the book in question, the presumption that it really is Solomon we are talking about is very strong. However, there's a problem here, because he says, I got wisdom above all they that were before me in Jerusalem. How many is all? Well, one apparently. And to get more wisdom above one that was before me in Jerusalem doesn't really seem to justify the word all. For who was Solomon's predecessor? Answer, David. And who reigned previously in Jerusalem? Well, it certainly wasn't Saul. To the best of my knowledge, the nearest name that we can get is somebody called, what's his name now? Adonizedek, I think. Living in the time of the Judges, or in Joshua's day. He was very severely punished by Joshua for being a very bad king. And before that, you only have Melchizedek, king of Salem, that I know about as being kings in Jerusalem. So that there is a bit of a problem when Solomon says, I had more wisdom than all that were before me in Jerusalem. I don't really know where Saul reigned. He didn't seem to have a very fixed court. David spent the first 7.5 years of his reign reigning in Hebron in the south of Judea. He moved to Jerusalem in the days when the house of Saul discontinued their rebellion and they were able to capture the citadel of the Jebusites. And for the last 32 years of his reign was king there. And then Solomon succeeded him. So it does seem a little bit surprising at first sight that Solomon should say, I got me more wisdom than all that were before me in Jerusalem. However, we can bear in mind that there were previous kings. It's not so unreasonable to mention Melchizedek, who was a man so wise and so great that the letter to the Hebrews stands back from him in wonder and says, consider how great this was, to whom our father Abraham gave tithes of all. So he might have been referring to him. And anyhow, there's another way out. For if you could turn to 1 Kings, chapter 4, verse 30, this is how the wisdom of Solomon is described. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman and Chalcol and Dada the sons of Mahol. And his fame was in all nations round about, and he spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. And he spake of trees from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. He spake also of beasts and fowl and of creeping things and of all fishes. And there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all kings of the earth which had heard of his wisdom. And amongst the various people than whom Solomon was wiser, there are mentioned in verse 31, Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, and Chalcol, and Dada, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the nations round about. Now you only have to say that Ethan and Heman and Chalcol and Dada and Mahol all lived in Jerusalem, say, and were there before Solomon sat on the throne, and there you have, I was wiser than all men that were before me in Jerusalem. There was a college of wise men there, and Solomon says, I was wiser than the lot, which makes very good sense. Especially when we bear in mind that this man, Ethan the Ezrahite, is actually mentioned in the title of Psalm 89 as being one of those persons who were concerned with the wise things that David did before Solomon ever came to the throne. So I shall take it for granted and is adequately established that the person who writes this book is Solomon the son of David, who was granted the wisdom by God that came to him when he was approached by God in a dream by night, and God asked him what he would have. Now, there is a little bit of contributory evidence, I think, in the second chapter of this book, where Solomon describes his great works. I mean, the preacher describes his great works. Verse 4 of chapter 2. I made me great works. I builded me houses, I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them, of all kind of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle, above all that were before me in Jerusalem. I gathered me also silver and gold, and the peculiar treasure of kings of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, as musical instruments and that of all sorts, a passage which incidentally the Revised Version changes significantly to, and concubines, very many. So I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Now I don't think you can, one by one, trace an identity between those various things that the preacher says he did, and the various things that the books of Kings and Chronicles say that Solomon did, but you can go a good long way there. For example, I made me great works, I builded me houses. Which houses? Well, the house of God, his own house, 7 years and 13 years respectively, the house of the forest of Lebanon, the house of Pharaoh's daughter. There's four. That fits in very well with Solomon's activities. I planted me vineyards and made me gardens and parks. Well, whereas I know of little evidence inside the books of Kings and Chronicles for that, certainly the picture given in the Song of Solomon is that of a man who was well equipped with this kind of thing. The planting of trees and the use of the abundant resources of the earth to make sure that when trees were cut down, young trees grew to replace them, which they were watered in his parks, suggests some kind of sovereignty over the forests of Lebanon that we have seen reason in today's Chronicles reading to believe that Solomon had. And the concubines, very many. Only needs a small addition sum of 700 plus 300 from the lists given in the Kings and Chronicles records for us to see to what extent Solomon did indulge himself in that particular delight of the flesh, and how true it was of him that, verse 10, whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labour, and this was my portion of all my labour. However, having identified, as I would assume that we have, Solomon in his wisdom and his greatness and his mighty works, we come across one stupendous problem. He was so wise that the Queen of Sheba almost swooned in wonder. He was so wise that they came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. He was so wise that the Lord Jesus could commend the humility of that great queen who did come and sit at his feet and learn of the greatness that was told to him. And she herself could say, the heart was not told me. And yet, he married Pharaoh's daughter. In his old age, he married many strange women. His heart turned him aside from the ways of the Lord his God. His folly was so calamitous that it sealed the fate of the United Kingdom, and it was during his reign that the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite said to the successor of Solomon on the northern kingdom that you, Jeroboam, will take 10/12 of this kingdom and I will leave but one extra part for the son of Solomon. He was so cruel, it seems, so burdensome a taskmaster, that one of the major complaints against him when Jeroboam came to present the petition of the children of Israel to him, to his son at Jerusalem, was, thy father made our yoke heavy. How do you reconcile the request of Solomon in his prayer to God that he might be given great wisdom, and the clear understanding that God had granted him the answer to that request, and he would indeed be given it? How do you reconcile the first act of wisdom where he settled the problem as to whose child the disputed child was by calling for a sword, with the accumulation of multiple follies of which Solomon was guilty throughout a very large portion of his life? Well, I don't know, but I think perhaps one of the best ways that I know of looking at this is something like this. If you come to me for advice, it's not at all certain that you'll get good advice, but there's quite a chance you might. If I come to me for good advice, whereas I might give myself very good advice indeed, like you, I might not follow it. Now, you see what I mean? If you can stand outside yourself, you can be very wise indeed. And because I'm always standing outside yourselves, if you ask me for advice, I am a disinterested party, and you'll get the best I have to offer. By the way, I said a disinterested party. Will you please mark with a very bad mark anybody who ever says disinterested when they mean uninterested? Somebody who is bored is uninterested. Somebody who has got no personal interest in the case, in that he's not prejudiced, is disinterested. So put that in your vocabulary and get it right. Now, if you were to come to me for advice, you would get, very likely, disinterested advice. But when you went away, you would follow your own counsels, and you'd either do it or you wouldn't. Every now and again, there might be a bit of a nagging in your conscience. You might say, that wise man Alfred Norris told me this would happen if I went the other way. and I've gone and done it. If only I'd been warned in time. Now, I do that to Alfred Norris quite a bit. Quite a lot of times I say to myself, if only you'd followed what you knew to be right, this wouldn't have happened to you. If only you'd taken your own good advice, you'd have been far better situated than you are now. If only you'd had the sense to do what you were plainly understanding from the Word of God was the course of action called of you, you'd have saved yourself a lot of trouble. Now, I think it's perfectly possible to be both wise and foolish in that way. To stand on a stage and look at yourself. To sit upon the seat of judgment and watch yourself in the dark, squirming. To give advice which you may or may not follow. I suspect that Solomon was very like that. He was so gifted by God, he had so shrewd a knowledge of what life was like, that he could, at almost all times of his life, stand outside what was going on, look at it with a calm and dispassionate eye, and say, that's the way one ought to go. Or, that's what happens when you don't go the way you ought to go. And the man who was most obviously before his gaze, and whom he placed most conspicuously in the dock, was Solomon. So you have Solomon, the wise man, whom we now divide into two parts. One part being Solomon, the other part being the wise man. And the wise man tells Solomon what to do, which he usually doesn't. And the wise man watches him not doing it, and can foresee the consequences of it, and see the folly of it, and knows what will be the ultimate outcome of that, unless Solomon changes his ways and becomes better. So that when, for example, as we've read already, I gave my heart to do this and that, my wisdom remaining with me, Solomon means, I could see myself going the wrong way. I watched myself doing what I shouldn't be doing. I observed the consequences of it, and now in my own experience I know how true it was, and how right was the advice I gave myself. In this, Solomon is distinguished very sharply from someone else, who was given wisdom to such an extent that we are told God giveth not the Spirit by measure to him. Who had, I would say, the kind of understanding of the ways of God, of what is right and what is wrong, which was never equaled by anybody, but to which Solomon was the best approach. And yet whose way of life was such that, seeing the way he ought to go, being able to stand outside himself and watch whether he was going that way or not, he always went that way. He always took the good advice that his wisdom gave him, always followed the counsel which the Spirit of God placed before him, never turned aside to the right hand or the left, was able from time to time to look at his progress in the ways of God and say, which of you convicteth me of sin? I do always those things which please my Father. And at the end could look back upon a life lived perfectly without any fault at all and say, I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. It is finished. A greater than Solomon is here, the Lord said. And though the greatness lay not only in the fact that he was the Son of God, which Solomon was not in the fundamental sense, yet the greatness lay also in the fact that the Lord followed the wisdom that was given to him, and Solomon in his wisdom merely watched himself not doing, at least to a very large extent. And that is why there is such, at first sight, a disillusioned book, yet such a truthful book. A book that strikes such a somber note, and yet in that somber note reveals life as to a very large extent it really is. And it is why, taking the first part of our officially appointed section of the study, the writer could write in the first few verses of chapter 1, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labour which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labour. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. Let me draw you that picture in my own words. The earth abideth forever, we will take as our stage. Here it is. The earth. Permanent. Fixed. Unmovable. What's going on around the earth? Well, for one thing, the sun's rising. The sun rises in the east. I don't know which is the east, we'll assume that it's that. The sun rises in the east, reaches its zenith, goes down to the west and disappears. One daylight day is gone. Well, has the sun finished its journey? No, next morning there it is, as sure as the previous day. Up in the east again, rising once more, reaching its zenith, and setting. And the day after. And all the days that there's anybody there to look at it, the sun rises in the east, goeth about into the west, and then goeth back into its place, to start again next day. Which teaches the cynical person, not very much perhaps, except that it never seems to get where it's going to. It's always back at the same place next day. There's a constant monotony in life where nothing seems to be achieved, at least as far as the sun is concerned. It's a mere empty repetition, endless in its ways. Vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. All is vanity. Well, leave the sun for the moment. You try the wind. Well, the wind bloweth about continually. Thou canst not tell whence it cometh or whither it goeth. Does that awaken a memory? Somebody else was to say something like that a bit later. Thou canst not tell whence it cometh, when the wind bloweth where it listeth. So is every one that is born of the Spirit, says the Lord. A very different conclusion from the very same phenomenon is drawn by Solomon and the greater than Solomon, at least at this stage. Solomon speaking of futility, and the Lord speaking of the unseen, secret but very effective workings of God, as undiscernible as the ways of the wind, but as fruitful as the birth of the Spirit. We might come back to that, but for the moment, the wind blows about continually. It returns to its place, and again you have the idea of random movements of air, blowing here and blowing there, bringing with them rain, drying up the rain they form, but never getting anywhere. It's always windy somewhere. If it goes calm, it's always windy again. There's no certainty, no security, no finality about the movement of wind. And then it rains. It rains, and the water falls into the rivers, and the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. And to the place to which the waters go, we are told, thither they return again. How do they do it? Why, the surface of the waters evaporate, of course. And the vapour goes up into the air, and there it forms clouds once more. And then something happens that causes the water of the clouds to precipitate as rain, or snow, or hail. And these things come down and fall upon the earth, and either at once, if they're rain, or when they melt, if they're snow, they go down into the rivulets, and the streams, and the rivers, and the sea. And the process goes again of evaporation, cloud forming, precipitation, and all the rest. So you have a sun cycle, a wind cycle, a water cycle, and what else do you have? You have one generation passeth away, and another generation cometh. Well, that's another sort of cycle, isn't it? Well, it is too. They call it the nitrogen cycle, and the carbon cycle, and all the other unpleasant things, whereby they describe what happens to our, well, the air we breathe when we take the carbon dioxide and make it into the stuff of our bodies. Or the nitrogen we take in the very expensive beefsteak or the less expensive pulses. And what that makes in our bodies and the various ways in which we get rid of it. And the various ways in which ultimately we are got rid of. That's the difference between the water cycle and the wind cycle and the air cycle and the sun cycle, I mean. Oh yes, the nitrogen comes and goes. It goes into the skies and the lightning comes and you get oxides and it's washed down and you get nitric acid and then you get nitrates with the lime and then, well, they sprinkle it on the land and the beans grow on it or the nitrifying bacteria eat it and then they make things that you can eat yourself and ingest. The nitrogen atoms are going round and round, all right, and so are the carbon atoms, but not the people. One generation passeth away and another generation cometh. Well, you can look at the stage and you can see there's a baby just crawled onto the stage there. It can barely crawl at all. And about this point, it's grown up into a tall, strong young man, strutting rather than walking. And here it's wondering, perhaps, whether it's got the halfway stage and looking around for a crutch. And there it's hobbling on in very uncertain ways, and by the time it gets to the end of the stage, it falls off. Dead. Meanwhile, of course, it's perfectly true there's somebody else with crutches there, and somebody standing up and wondering here, and somebody strutting around there, and another baby crawling on there. It goes on and on, all right, but it's not the same people doing it. It isn't that the baby grows up and becomes strong and gets weaker and falls off and crawls underneath and comes back. Not like the sun. It's one generation passeth away and another generation cometh. And that's the difference. So as the writer looks upon the stage of human endeavour, he sees permanence in the earth, constant repetitions in the sun and the wind and the waves. But in man he sees coming, growing, and going. And that's the end for each generation. And he says, what's the use of that? And in various ways, as this book goes on, he finds a variety of reasons for wondering what is the use of that. You could almost list them as you went on. Just try a few from the early chapters. We have found in the first chapter that man is the one fleeting thing amongst the permanent but meaningless things, apparently meaningless, which he's discussed. Try seeing what he says about his own wisdom. Chapter 1, verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the Son of Man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and the vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estates. I have gotten more wisdom than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart hath had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. That's an overall picture. But he divides it into various parts. And one part, which is a very attractive part for this day, and is constantly being tried by all kinds of people, is that which is described in the first few verses of chapter 2. I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? There are several points in this book where Solomon, looking at things from an earthly point of view, decides that the vanity of human existence being what it is, the inability of the human mind to search out the deep things of God being the shallow thing that it is, and the purpose of God itself being as inscrutable to the feeble mind of man as necessarily it must be, that because and if and in so far as you can't find any purpose in life, then you may as well enjoy yourself. And he says, let us eat and drink. But pause a minute. It's easy to go further than that and say, let us eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Easy to go further than that and say, there is no meaning of life, it doesn't matter what we do, we may as well enjoy ourselves while we can. And this is a philosophy which has overtaken the world in our present time, where the bottom has dropped out of life, where to a very large extent any true faith in God has been abandoned by multitudes of mankind, where increasingly when the word of God is mentioned in public at all, the name of God is mentioned only as abuse, to support a blasphemy, as a buttress to an oath, and where decreasingly is it used with any reverence and respect, with any recognition that God exists. Where to replace that word, a variety of other words have come into the place empty and swept and garnished. The seven demons, worse than anything that was there before, encroaching upon the human mind with its blasphemies, with its filthinesses, with its sex symbols, with its thoughts of things that might be done, with the actual doing of those things, with the corruption and the invasion of the human mind, and the corresponding dangers attaching to the human body, as certain diseases attaching only to nameless acts become more and more frequent, more and more irresistible in the world. There is steadily growing a corruption in our age which arises from that factor which the Apostle Paul sums up quite briefly in Romans chapter 1 when he says, because they did not like to entertain God in their thoughts. God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not suitable. And this is a world that does not like to entertain God in its thoughts. This is a world where a reprobate mind is gaining the upper hand. This is where doing things which are not suitable is the ordinary common God talk of currency of talk, which goes on in all kinds of quarters. It's a day where corruption stares one in the face, stares one impudently and blatantly and without shame in the face, wherever one cares to go. It's a day when let us eat, drink and be merry. Let us do more than that. Let us marry and give in marriage. Let's do without the marriage, but merely accept the pleasures. Let us do what they did in Sodom. Let us make anything lawful if it's done between consenting adults in private, and it needn't be very private at that. No more private than a TV screen at all events. Let us go to that stage of life and, well, there's no purpose in it, so why not? Now this, Solomon found out, from rather too much personal experience, was madness and folly. But in fact the counsel he gives himself throughout this book is never, because there is no God, let us do this. It's a strange thing. But everywhere in this book Solomon takes God's existence for granted. Even though he goes into foolish acts, even though he gives way to unworthy thoughts, though he lets himself indulge in all kinds of pleasure and luxury, there is no point at which he says, and there's no God looking. He is never, like the person castigated in the Psalms, the fool who says in his heart there is no God. He is always the fool who knows in his heart that there is a God, and if he does foolish things, does it in spite of that knowledge. And the best that we reach in some of the purely material parts of this book, which rises to greater heights than that, is that he says, well, God is up to something, I'm quite sure, but I don't know what it is. We must make the best of the knowledge we do have about God. And when he says, as he does, there is nothing better than a man should eat and drink and enjoy the fruits of his labour, he adds, this also I saw that it was from the hand of God. Now that's a much healthier attitude than the one which we commonly get in our day. He says in effect, we must bide our time. If we learn about the purpose of God, then there may be better things for us to do than we are now doing. But until such time as we know what God is doing, then at least let us recognize that he exists. At least let us say thank you for what he's given us. At least when we enjoy the food he has given and the drink he's provided and the delights of marriage, living joyfully with the wives or the husbands of our youth, let us know that this is from God's hand, and let us in all our pleasure-making be thankful pleasure-makers. Be grateful for the things that God gives. He never actually goes back on that. When as this book unfolds, he comes to reveal to us that there is a purpose from God of which we can know something. When he tells us more about what that purpose is and looks beyond the emptiness of this life, left to itself, into a fullness of life which there is yet to come, then at that point he tells us there are two ways of looking at God's gifts, of which one is to be very happy with the things he's given us now, and the second is, having done it so innocently that God is able to accept our rejoicing without reproach and without condemnation, to look forward to a time when there is still very much better to come. For the moment, though, we have found ourselves in the position of meeting a man who is two men. A man who, standing outside himself, is very wise and knows what's right and knows what's wrong. A man whose heart within himself is by no means as steadfast as that, who knows all the follies of youth and weakness, and who, turning aside to do those things, sits in judgment on himself and says, this is madness and folly. A man who knows all kinds of disappointments. The loneliness of having satisfied one's lust, but knowing that the company one has gathered around oneself is therefore the profit it can make of one's own riches. So that although he may speak occasionally of a faithful friend, can speak of the women he's gathered in his company and say, a woman amongst a thousand, which is the right total, a woman amongst a thousand have I not found. A man who, for all his counsellors, knows that his friends are time servers, and knows the loneliness of being by himself in his wisdom. A man who gathers great riches and sees those riches and says, well, you can't eat gold. Looks around at his pleasures and his sheep and his oxen and his vineyards and says, well, I suppose mutton's very good, but I've lost the taste for it, and my palate can no longer savour my fine wines. A man who looks into the future beyond his death and says, what have I got? There's only that Rehoboam, and he's not much good. And so I gather together these things by my wisdom, and who knoweth whether it shall be a fool that inherits it. And all these things are the kind of disappointments and disillusionments which come to the life of a man who for far too long and with far too little excuse lets himself go the ways of folly, ignore the ways of God, and yet with a strange fatalism sees himself doing it and observes the end of those things. I have to start this thing very largely on a pessimistic note. It will rise to higher levels as we go on, probably as early as the next 10 minutes from now. But for the time being, let us take stock of our personal selves. Those who are in the midst of surroundings where disillusionment could very easily capture us, who are tempted to follow in the empty, vain ways of the world around us and pursue pleasure and be very unhappy in doing so, who are provoked and cajoled and almost threatened to conform to the ways of life of those who say in their hearts there is no God, who are tempted to adopt their fashions, to assume their garbs, to put upon our faces their uncouth expressions which betray no joy at all, to say, let us eat and drink and be miserable, for tomorrow we die. Whereas in this book there is not this counsel, but a true and just, a sober and a thought-provoking assessment of what life is like when God is ignored, followed by something we shall come to where, remembering our Creator, there dawns a newer, greater, a more serene and a more permanent happiness.